Welcome to episode 9 of Fire Away, Radner Law's online question and answer show focusing on the issues that of employment law that matter to you. My name is Stuart Rudner. I'm an employment lawyer and mediator and your host for today. Our show broadcasts every month, usually on the third Tuesday of the month. We love it when you guys tune in live. We love it even more when you ask questions. So if you do have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them. Feel free to either make comments on Facebook or YouTube, or you can also use Twitter and make sure to direct them to @RudnerLaw. Also a reminder that if you are not watching this live, you can always catch up on episodes. They're always available on Facebook, YouTube, and our website. And if you like us or follow us on social media, you'll get reminders about upcoming shows. Every month we have a guest, and this month I'm very excited to have Anton Katz. Anton is a corporate commercial and civil litigation lawyer in Toronto. He's got 22 years of experience advising small businesses with their diverse opportunities and challenges, and as he puts it, with their agreements and disagreements. This month, Anton and I are going to be discussing the sale of a business, and specifically the employment law issues that arise when there is a sale of a business. What happens if the purchaser doesn't want to keep all of the employees? Who pays the severance? What happens if the employees don't want to join the new company? Do they have to take the job? Do they have to sign a new contract? Can the seller be prevented from working in the industry or competing against the company they just sold? All of these issues can get very complicated. At Rudner Law, we work with our clients on how to minimize their costs and their risks. Usually in the context of a purchase and sale of a company, we work with a corporate commercial lawyer, which is why we wanted to have someone like Anton Katz join us. And as usual, at the end of the show, I will have my chance to offer my views when I fire away. But first, I want to welcome Anton to the show. Anton, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you for having me on the show today.
I'm looking forward to the conversation. As I said, the time always flies by, so let's get right into it. First of all, can you tell me a bit about how your practice relates to the sale of a business?
Okay, well, as you've mentioned, I've been practicing for 22 years, and a large part of my practice is corporate and commercial law. Where that ties into employment law issues is, as you point out, in the sale of a business. It ties in the sense that more often than not, there are employees that are coming over from the old business to the new business.
Yeah, and that's, of course, where I come in. But before we get into that in more detail, we always talk about sale of a business. The reality, as I understand it, is you can sell a business in two different ways with very different consequences. So can you just explain what those are?
So typically, the two ways to sell a business are by way of assets or by way of shares. Asset sale is where you select the assets. It can be all or substantially all of the assets of the business that are being sold. A share sale is different because there you're not selling individual assets, you're selling the shares. And by selling the shares indirectly, you're selling the assets.
Got it. So in a share purchase, which as I understand it basically means that the purchasers are just stepping into the shoes of the vendor, the organization is not changing. If it's ABC company that you work for, you still work for ABC company after the sale. It's just that ABC company is now owned by different people. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's the owner is the same. The corporation is the same, but the owners of the corporation, of course, will change.
So sometimes the situation that I have seen, and I know you've seen it as well, is you have a share purchase and you've got new owners of the same company. They take all of the employees, or perhaps they haven't closed the sale yet and they're going to assess, you know, whether they need all of the employees. So before I get to my question, Rob, we do have a great clip which can illustrate what happens in that case. So maybe we can take a look at that.
Attention workers, we have completed our evaluation of the plan. We regret to announce the following layoffs, which I will read in alphabetical order. Simpson, Homer. That is all.
Thanks, Rob. And poor Homer, of course. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I've ever seen it happen where a purchaser went through an entire large organization of, I think, hundreds of people and identified one they didn't want to keep, as in The Simpsons. But I've certainly seen it happen where purchasers have said, look, we're not interested in either a whole group or a large percentage, or even in some cases, we don't want anybody because we're not going to continue running the business. So what options are available to a purchaser if they don't want to keep all the employees?
So the purchaser can go back to the vendor and request that the vendor terminate the employment of those employees. That's the main thing that can be done.
And so if, and one of the things I'm going to mention in my, when I fire away at the end is the fact that a lot of times companies don't turn their minds to these issues until after the sale is complete, which is obviously a pet peeve of mine. You're talking about pre-closing?
Yes. So pre-closing, that those terminations happen prior to closing. The vendor does an assessment as to what the person's entitlement is and gives them notice or pay in lieu of notice.
And so, I mean, this to me is a critical point. I know we talked about this off the air many times, Anton, but it's critical that both parties turn their minds to these issues before closing and ideally before they finalize the agreement to purchase and sale. Because I think we've both seen situations where parties are in a rush. You know, you've got someone who wants to sell their business and they see a huge payday coming up. You've got a purchaser who wants to acquire the business. They rush into an agreement of purchase and sale, and they never think about the fact that there are, you know, dozens or hundreds or thousands of employees and who might be on the hook for the costs. So assuming that they are the enlightened ones and they've got a corporate lawyer like yourself who would say you should consider these issues and speak with an employment lawyer, or they come to a firm like ours and we say you need to consider these issues. Assuming that they address these issues before the agreement is finalized, what types of things would you recommend that be included in the agreement?
Well, I think it's important that, first of all, there are reps and representations and warranties from the vendor that it has, in fact, terminated the employment of the various employees or given suitable notice. It may be coupled with an undertaking by the vendor to give releases from those employees, whereby they acknowledge that the notice or pay in lieu is sufficient. And it may even be advisable for those releases to be supported by independent legal advice so as to ensure that the releases really are voluntary and effective. Those are sort of a continuum of things which you sometimes see.
Yeah, and that's certainly something we would recommend if we were acting for the purchaser. They want to be sure that they are covered and they have the flexibility to assess the workforce, as we saw in The Simpsons, and decide who they need and who they don't need, and in which case they'll have the opportunity. Now, worst case scenario, and I've seen this happen, where purchaser signs on to buy the company, and if it's a share purchase, as you explained already, they're buying the company lock, stock, and barrel, as they say, which includes all the employees. And I've seen situations where they buy the company, they've got, let's say, 500 employees. They realize that really this company was not well managed. It should be cut down to, let's say, 400 employees. But unless they had some agreement in the agreement to purchase and sale, they're on the hook for severance. So typically, and that's something that we often work with purchasers, to have a clause in the contract that says we have a certain period of time during which we can let people go. And if we choose to, either you, the purchaser, will be responsible for all the severance or will somehow share it. And I know you've seen that done as well, because we've collaborated on a few cases, but are there different ways that you've seen that sort of cost allocated?
Yeah, it's a really good point. So as you point out, in a share purchase, the purchaser acquires the company warts and all. That's another expression that you sometimes see used. So that includes the employees. And if no notice has been given to those employees or no pay in lieu prior to closing, the purchaser steps into the shoes of the vendor. And you may have employees that have been there for a very short time or for a very long time. So then, you know, you have to consider to prepare a clause or have a clause in there which speaks to the situation of the purchaser terminating the employment, and then, you know, who's responsible for paying the termination pay, because now it's post-closing. So presumably it would be the purchaser, but there's nothing to prevent the parties in the agreement from saying that if, for example, it's the first 3 months after closing, the vendor pays, or if it's within the first 12 months, the parties share that obligation equally. Certainly seeing clauses like that.
Yeah, as have I. And of course, if you're acting for the vendor, you don't want to see those clauses. You
know, correct.
The vendor wants to finalize, close the deal, and just walk into the sunset, so to speak.
Yes, Yes.
But this can, and I don't want to minimize this, because this can be hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in severance obligations. And you made a good point. We're talking about the staff. They may be short-term, but they may be long-term. And I've seen situations where businesses are bought. You've got some employees who've been there 15, 20, 25 years, and there is no strong contract of employment in place that would limit their entitlement to severance. So you now, if you want to let them go, you might be on the hook, you know, for each employee for 18, 20, 24 months of severance. Multiply that by 100 employees, and, you know, let's say they're averaging $60,000 a year. That's a lot of money. And I've seen this happen to purchasers where, you know, they bought a company and all of a sudden they're spending double what they expected to because they need to downsize. So you make a great point that you can address this up front. If there's nothing, let's assume that it's a share purchase. There's nothing in the agreement of purchase and sale about allocating severance costs, then they simply fall on the purchaser, right?
That's correct. It would fall on the purchaser. And so another way of doing it is just to adjust the purchase price as well. If the purchaser is taking on all the employees, but reasonably thinks that he or she or it is going to let go a certain number of them, then maybe the purchase price should be reduced to factor that in as well, because these can be significant dollar amounts. And rather than, you know, figure it out after closing and go back and adjust the purchase price, you can just do it, you know, right. The purchase price itself can be adjusted from the beginning.
That's a great point. That's a good way to deal with that up front and not have to try to figure it out later. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And this is something that, you know, another way that we often get involved, because like I said before, we often work in conjunction with corporate lawyers like yourself, Anton, because you guys are driving the deal. We're looking at a very small part of it. But one thing that we always recommend to the purchaser is the vendor should produce all the contracts of employment for their staff. And we can now review the contracts, review all the data, and give them an assessment as to what the cost might be if they want to let one or two or thousands of them go. So that's one way that we can get involved. So that's all in the context of a share purchase. Let's talk a bit about asset purchases. So if ABC company sells some of its assets, what does that mean as far as the employees?
So the employees are not assets. That's a pretty obvious point to make. The employees are not assets. So they don't automatically go along with the transaction. It's for the purchaser to decide whether it wishes to employ them, to make offers of employment to those employees. It doesn't necessarily follow that they're going to go along with the transaction.
Right, and that's a really important distinction. Share purchase, employees just follow along. Asset purchase, they don't automatically, which creates a whole lot of uncertainty for the employees. First of all, as to whether they'll have a job. But second of all, what I often see is the purchaser basically says to the employees, yeah, it's just going to be business as usual. Just keep coming to work next week and nothing changes. But of course, a lot of employees just blindly do that without realizing that their employment was terminated. And this is where we often advise individuals that if the company was sold, technically that's a termination of your employment. And you will have an entitlement to termination pay under the Employment Standards Act in Ontario or other provinces. You may have an entitlement to severance or a common law notice. But the other question that often comes up is, do they have to? You know, do they have to keep going to work, or do they have the choice at that point? Obviously, I can talk about that from the employment law.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But if you're acting for the purchaser, Antoine, and you have a purchaser who wants all of the employees to stay, how do they protect themselves to make sure that happens?
How do the employees protect themselves?
No, if you're acting for the vendor, I'll talk about the employment side, but if you're acting for the vendor and the vendor says to you, look, I want to make sure that we keep all the employees, how can they protect themselves?
Well, then they have to ensure that the purchaser does in fact make offers of employment to the employees to take them on. And then the purchaser, I guess, does step into the shoes of the vendor and is now responsible under those new contracts of employment for their termination pay obligations.
Yeah, and this is where it can become very complicated because it's not like a share purchase where life just goes on. In this case, the vendor is technically going to have to terminate the employment, and the purchaser is going to have to make offers of employment to those employees and make sure the employees accept. And if they don't accept, then they may lose those employees, which of course raises issues about what severance they're going to get. As I know we've asked, and I told you time would go by quickly, we've only got about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
One of the things I know we want to talk about, because this often comes up in the sale of a business, is the principal of the vendor. So you've built up a business, so with your blood and sweat and tears over years or decades of your life, you're now going to sell it. But in some cases, the purchaser wants the principal to stay. In some cases, they don't want the principal anywhere near there. But what have you seen in terms of how the purchasing company protects itself?
So often it's important for the purchaser to give thought to retaining the principal of the vendor. A lot of the goodwill of the business may be tied up with the vendor, his or her relationships with the employees, with the customers. So often what I see is employment agreements or even consulting agreements with the principal and the purchaser company.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's an important one. I mean, a lot of times one or both sides wants the principal of the vendor to stay. Like you said, the goodwill may be there. They may need that warm introduction by the vendor to the new owners so that they meet all the clients or the customers. But the flip side of this is a lot of times, you know, and there's a lot of case law on this point, you know, you sell your law firm to some up and coming lawyer. They don't want you to then open up a new law firm across the street and start contacting all of the clients and taking them away.
Right.
So how do you deal with that kind of situation?
So that's when you have them sign what's called a restrictive covenant agreement, or basically a non-solicitation or non-competition agreement, whereby they agree that while they're working with the purchaser, they're not going to compete against the purchaser or solicit its clients or employees. And I see that done both during the term of the agreement as well as for a period of time thereafter.
Yeah, I think that's critical. When we act for the purchasers, you want to make sure that, you know, that situation is not going to unfold where you're basically the person that sold you the company becomes your biggest competitor the next day or 6 months later for that matter. And one important thing to note, I mean, we're often called upon to advise people on non-competition agreements, non-solicitation agreements. And one thing we often say is non-competition agreements, or non-competes as they're usually called, are usually not enforceable in the employment context. If you have an employee, usually you can't stop them from going to a competitor, although you can stop them from soliciting your clients. Very different in the context of a sale of a business. And courts will look at that as being more of an agreement between two equals, as opposed to the big employee and the small employer, to use the generalization. So you can use a non-compete very effectively in the context of a sale of a business. And Anton, obviously, you'd be involved in assessing that for either side, as would we. But we're often called upon to advise the individuals who have sold the company. They want, you know, they may have thought they were going to retire and realized after a few months that retirement isn't quite for them. They want to get back into business. And now they're asking us if they can, or if this non-compete is going to stop them. Do you find that you get that question often as well?
Sorry, which question precisely?
Where the vendor of the company agreed to a non-compete, but now yes, wants to get back into the business.
Yes, I do see that. Sometimes retirement isn't as rosy as the vendor thought it would be. The vendor has second thoughts, has too much time on his or her hands, and wants to reconsider his or her decision to retire and not compete. But as you've pointed, I'll remind them that the considerations are different in a sale of a business than they are in that traditional employer-employee relationship. You don't have that imbalance of bargaining power. You have two generally sophisticated parties, and ordinarily the courts will hold them to their bargain. So they have to really think carefully as to the length of the non-compete, the length of the non-solicit, and in the case of the non-compete also, as you would be aware, the radius of the non-compete.
Yeah, great point. And I mean, I see, you know, as you've, you know, eloquently stated, I mean, courts will look at a non-compete as being reasonable if it's between two parties of equal bargaining power. but they will look at the terms. And if it's going to be 20 years, courts are going to say that's completely unreasonable. Or as I have seen, if it's, it cannot compete anywhere in the world, and this is a small company doing business in Hamilton, it's not going to be seen as reasonable. So courts will assess the reasonableness, but they're more likely to enforce a non-compete if it's a sale of a business. Same thing for non-solicit. They're far more likely to enforce it, again, as long as the terms are reasonable. So we're almost out of time. I know we were going to talk about contractors briefly. So this is, I guess, one of the things that I think you and I are both seeing a lot of, which is employees workers that are employees in all but name. They're called contractors. And there's a lot of risk for employers or companies that have these contractors because they really are employees. CRA can come down upon them and seek unpaid taxes. Ministry of Labor can come down upon them with penalties, and they can be found to be on the hook for severance. But from the sale of a business perspective, I know you wanted to raise this in that context, and maybe I'll just let you explain why you thought it was important in that sense.
Yeah, so again, the purchaser will want to review the various contracts that workers have with the vendor. Those contracts may say that they're independent contractor agreements, but ultimately, that may not be so. It may be that those workers are providing all their services to the vendor itself, and that all the other indicia of employment are really there. So it could be a trap for the unwary purchaser that it thinks it's taking on all these contractors. It then goes on to terminate the contractual relations, and then lo and behold, it discovers that those people were really employees, and then it has a very big expense in terminating the employment of what were really employees that it was taking on.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. It's one more potential minefield, which is just, you know, I guess one more reason why if you're buying or selling a business, obviously you need to work with a corporate commercial lawyer. You need to have the advice of an employment lawyer as well. And that's why often Anton and I will work together to collaborate and give the clients on either side of the deal the advice they need. And when they don't do that, they often end up with these surprise bills for contractors that are really employees or employees that are entitled to 2 years of severance when the purchaser doesn't want them. So that is all the time that we have. So Anton, thank you so much for joining us today. That was really helpful. And
thank you for having me on the show as well. It's always interesting to chat about these issues, and they're certainly interesting and usually not very simple either.
No, that's why we need guys like you to give the advice that you do. Mm-hmm. If anybody's interested in learning more about Anton, I would direct you to his website, which is www.amklaw.ca. Anton, thanks again. Okay, now it is my turn to fire away. So I'll get right to the point. If you're involved in the sale of a business, whether you're the vendor or the purchaser, please, please make sure to consult with an employment lawyer. I've seen far too many people who end up in very bad situations because they didn't bother to get advice about the issues that arise when you sell a business, and they didn't understand what the potential costs or liabilities might be. And I'll give you an example up front. Obviously, I'll keep this anonymous, but there was a situation I was involved in about 6 months ago where two partners had built up a business in downtown Toronto over probably about 10 or 12 years. They decided they were going to retire. They got a good offer. Purchaser was only interested in the land, not surprising in downtown Toronto, I suppose. They had no interest in continuing to operate the business. And thank God the corporate commercial lawyer in that case was smart enough to tell them, look, you need to go see an employment lawyer. They came to see my firm, and we explained to them that, look, all of your employees are going to lose their jobs. And unless you build some safety into the agreement of purchase and sale, you guys are going to be on the hook for severance. And we did some really quick math. They had about, I think, 80 employees in that case. And what looked like a payday of about $1.5 million quickly became a payday of about $700,000 after they factored in all the severance costs that they would be on the hook for. Luckily, in that case, they got advice up front. They hadn't signed anything. And we were able to work with their corporate commercial lawyer to increase the purchase price because of that. But I've also seen cases where people don't get advice up front. They enter into agreements where either as the vendor, they're on the hook for significant severance costs, or as the purchaser, they don't take any time to do their due diligence. They don't understand or address what their costs might be if they have to let employees go. And they end up with 500 employees when they only need 400. And they didn't allocate the cost of termination. So if they want to let those extra 100 employees go, they're on the hook for substantial severance costs. So please get advice up front. In episode 9 of Fire Away, Anton Katz was my guest. Anton is a corporate commercial and civil litigation lawyer with over 2 decades of experience working with small businesses, including purchases and sales of business. He and I both know, and we've dealt with this situation many times, the simple reality is that when you sell a business, there are almost always employees that are involved and issues that arise because of that. What happens to the employees? Do they just go with the business? What if the purchaser doesn't want to keep them? What if the purchaser says, you know, you can have your job, but you've got to sign this new, extremely onerous contract? You as the employee have to sign it. This can be worth hundreds of thousands. It can be worth millions of dollars to either the vendor or the purchaser. And what drives me crazy is that the corporate entities will spend months negotiating every nuance of the sale, but they never turn their minds to the employment issues. Or I will get a call from a corporate commercial at 4 p.m. on a Thursday saying they want me to have a quote-unquote quick look at an agreement of purchase and sale. And when I ask when the deal is closing, it's tomorrow. It's way too late, but this seems to happen all the time. And I don't mean to fault corporate commercial lawyers, because I think in most cases, they're advising their clients to see an employment lawyer or to get them involved. But in many cases, the clients, you know, get scared off by having another lawyer and more legal fees involved, which I understand. Legal fees are expensive, but the reality is you could spend a couple of $1,000 and find out what your exposure is, or you could not find out and then get a bill for a couple of $100,000 or a couple of $1 million later on. So to me, it's money that is certainly well spent. That's from the corporate side. If you're an employee, I see this all the time where people are just told the company's been sold. But in many cases, they're told, you know what, it's just business as usual. Keep coming into the same office, same desk. Everything is the same. You're just going to be paid by a new company, or it might even be the same company. Do they have to? That's a question that we sometimes get. What if they don't want to work for the new company? What happens if they choose not to? Does that mean they don't get severance, or are they entitled to it anyways? Or what happens if they're asked to sign a new contract? And what I often see is you've got someone who has no contract. Their severance entitlement might be 12, 15, 20 months. And now they're being asked to sign a contract with a new company that says, we're not going to recognize your past service. And if we let you go, you're going to get your employment standards minimum notice and nothing more, which means they've just gone from 15 or 20 months severance to maybe a couple of weeks. What happens if they choose not to sign? These are all issues that are critical. And yet it amazes me that people don't spend $500 to get advice from a lawyer so they understand it. They will either just sign and hope it all gets better. These are things that can't be ignored. And I encourage everyone to get the employment law advice. And I'll say what I often say at the end of Fire Away, which is that if you think you need an employment lawyer, you probably do. If you're in that situation, if you're selling a business, buying a business, if your company is being sold and you're being told that there's a new owner, get employment advice from an employment lawyer before, not after. Bottom line is these issues can be significant. So you need to get advice. And make sure you know your rights. And at Rudner Law, that's our job. Our job is to explain these issues to you so you understand them, you can make an informed decision. And like I always say, feel free to reach out. And if we can't help you, we'll tell you that. But if we can, it's going to be money well spent. And as we often say, we will get you the best results we can. So that's my 2 cents worth, and you got it here for free today.